Hello. Welcome to our podcast, Blethers With, which accompanies our textbook, Criminal Justice in Scotland, published by Routledge. This episode is a blether with David Russell, who at this time was a Community Safety and Justice Manager at Midlothian Council. In our conversation, we talk about his belief in the value of restorative justice, a response to crime and harm centering on mediated communication between people involved in an offence, and the challenges of using restorative approaches to deal with serious and emotive forms of offending. We also talk more generally about community justice, including in a rural context. Later in the episode, David reflects on the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on community justice and talks us through his own career pathway. Also, just a quick content warning, this episode includes a few mentions of sexual harm, including involving children. These take place between about 7 to 17 minutes into the episode, and again, more briefly, at about the 23 to 24 minute mark. This episode accompanies chapter 6 of the book, but you're welcome to listen to it on its own. Either way, thanks for listening.
Hi everyone, welcome to Blethers With. I am today's host Gerdalis Nurmia, and I am a second year social sciences student at Edinburgh Napier University.
And I'm Jamie Buchan, a lecturer in criminology here at Edinburgh Napier and one of the authors of our forthcoming textbook, Criminal Justice in Scotland.
Today we are blethering with David Russell, a Community Safety and Justice Manager working for the Midlothian Council. And today's topic is justice social work. So let's get down to business. And good afternoon, David.
Afternoon.
If you could be so kind and describe your day-to-day life, like just a regular day in the office for you. Especially since I'm assuming that not many people realise that social work is directly involved in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, so I have a role as a community justice manager. So I kind of sit within the justice social work team, but have a very different role in terms of the operational delivery. So we have oversight to kind of justice services, but more importantly, the Community Justice Outcome Improvement Plan, which really covers a range of different themes. And I suppose one of the big areas that we focus a lot on at the moment is around restorative justice and looking at how we can include survivors' voices within our justice system. So that's a real big part in terms of our partnership working with third sector agencies. We have a kind of local partnership board and working group where we have a range of different partners, including Police Scotland, criminal justice, ourselves as justice partners, and also the Violence Against Women and Girls Network. So we've got a real range of different professionals and third sector groups that we work kind of holistically with to kind of achieve our action planning.
And what kind of particular services do you guys provide? If there's anything, like a couple that you could maybe bring out?
Yep. So here at Number 11, we're really proud of Number 11. So it's a kind of hub approach. So we share the space with ourselves, community justice, justice services, so the statutory social work services. We also have mental health and health professionals in this building as well. So it's a real kind of model building in terms of that multi-agency working. So the services that we have, particularly within community justice, are really specific around kind of restorative justice. So I'm currently the chair of the National Sexual Harm Development Group, hoped by Thriving Survivors, the third sector group, where we've been developing approaches and delivery for cases of sexual harm and restorative practice. So here at MID, we also have a restorative justice practitioner, and I believe we're one of the kind of first local authorities to really bring that post in a really early stage of the development of restorative justice across the national landscape. And that the RJ practitioner co-delivers cases of restorative justice in Midlothian, and those cases are ranging from youth circle work to cases of murder as well, and where we support families in the recovery process of homicide.
We're currently sitting in the Number 11 Centre in Dalkeith in Midlothian. It's a relatively small town within a relatively small and predominantly rural local authority. And I was just wondering, David, if you'd have any comment about how that rural aspect affects your work.
Yeah. I mean, I came from working in Edinburgh, which is very different. And it's funny because I thought Dalkeith would be just the same as Edinburgh. That's how naive I was to Midlothian, really. I think Midlothian's brilliant. I think it's got so many different bits to it. And having that real aspect is really interesting. I think what we have identified is the links to transport are a bit of an issue in terms of how do we get people better connected. So what we're trying to do, I suppose, locally as a kind of community planning partnership is work together with our different areas of expertise and also using the kind of local community councils to kind of influence how we can improve some of the links. Because that's a real area in terms of people getting access to different services. So if there's a service in Edinburgh, for example, the links to transport can be quite difficult. But also the different demographic within Midlothian is really significant in terms of it's small, but it's one of the fastest growing populations in Scotland. And I think that's the bit we're going to see the differences in terms of how it grows and how it builds over the next few years will be really interesting.
So if we're on the topic of kind of development of restorative justice and as you work for the Midlothian Council, would you mind kind of explaining what is currently done to enhance the opportunities here, particularly in the rural, kind of more rural areas? Because I feel like a lot of the focus is more on bigger cities. So what do you guys are trying to do?
So within restorative justice, when the kind of national kind of approach came out from Scottish Government, I've always been a real advocate for restorative justice. And the one thing I always say is I didn't go looking for restorative justice. Restorative justice kind of found us or me in terms of supporting certain cases. So in my previous job, it was working with sibling sexual abuse cases and actually really quickly finding out that these restorative approaches and processes were incredibly helpful when working with younger siblings and younger children to reunify families opposed to taking the punitive kind of justice routes and also with children that were under the age of criminal responsibility. So with that in mind, when the kind of national approach came out, I was really keen to be involved in the development, particularly around the development of sexual harm cases. So we partnered up very early with Thriving Survivors, who were the kind of lead as a national hub for cases of sexual harm. And I now chair their advisory panel and I've contributed to the risk development tools that we're developing in terms of looking at people's suitability and capability for taking part in restorative justice. So what that partnership's done for us is when we have cases referred or we have people come forward in Midlothian and say we want to take part in restorative justice, or we have that partnership relationship where we can, with our own practitioner, be supported by Thriving Survivors and in one occasion as well, Community Justice Scotland, to co-deliver cases of RJ. So it's a really good approach and it's been really useful in terms of sharing the resource. And I think one of the big fears that's been going around is about funding and resourcing. And I think what we've tried to do is acknowledge the funding is very inconsistent, the resourcing is frightening, I suppose, over the next few years, but ultimately work as a partnership and kind of share resource and kind of share expertise and specialisms. So that's really allowed us to ensure we have some form of provision of RJ as and when required.
Perhaps you could say a bit more, David, about your partnership roles with organisations like Thriving Survivors and what they do in relation to restorative justice in cases of sexual harm.
Yeah. So Thriving Survivors were kind of given the role, I suppose, of the national group to roll out restorative justice in cases of sexual harm. And obviously that was no easy task. And we came up against quite a lot of contests in terms of different networks around this decision to include it. And one of the things that Thriving Survivors, who come from a real survivor-focused lens in terms of that is their place, is supporting survivors and victims of a range of different crime index, including sexual harm. One of the things that we both kind of agreed very early on as a partner to each other was that if survivors are asking for this, and based on their research that they conducted, the Survivors Voices paper, it was really about actually, if people are asking for this, there's an element of choice that's really needed, so people to have the opportunity and the choice to take part in restorative justice. And the other thing that always sat with me that I really hit home was, what's the risk in not taking part? What's the risk in not supporting the journey? And the risk of that is arguably that people will try and do it themselves, which will be unsupported, less protected, and no professionals around it. So we worked really closely with them to try and develop that. We've recently published a study in partnership with Community Justice Scotland, in which we interviewed 44 adult men convicted of a sexual offence. And that research was produced to understand the motivational factors of why someone who's committed that type of harm would want to take part. And we did that as a comparative consultation to survivors' voices to really look at the volunteerism aspects of RG and some of the issues and the mitigating factors we'd have to consider in assessment. And that's been a really useful piece. So, yeah, that partnership's developed really nicely. And I suppose that's the bit we're just continuing in our next 5-year action plan, being really clear about, you know, we develop the tools, we have all the things in place, and there's other partners, you know, that are part of that, working groups, risk groups, etc., to develop these tools and support the organisation to come up with a safe provision of RG. To go back to the research that we recently finished, which was about obviously sexual harm in cases of restorative justice in cases of sexual harm. What we did within that was really quickly understand and try to feed back was the large scale of index in terms of sexual offence. So the word sex offender just comes with so much stigma, and it's very misunderstood in terms of what it actually means. But what we were trying to determine was within that narrative is the risk factors and the vulnerability factors are very different depending on the sexual offence that's been committed. So an offence against a child poses a much different risk to an offence against an adult. And it's about, and it's in no shape or form minimising the impact of sexual harm or sexual assault in any way, but it's about understanding how these offences are different and they'll have different or less so or more so appropriate interventions dependent on the offence that's been committed. So I think it's, again, it's about breaking the barriers down, seeing the different thing. It's the same with theft. When you think of the word theft, it's massive. It's got so many different aspects to it. Drug use, substance use, you know, all these themes. They all have different breaks to them. But again, I do feel that the stigma, not helped by the media, in terms of they just summarise them in words, but we don't get the narratives to describe what these things actually mean. And I think that's the bit that's really critical when we're thinking about what's appropriate, what's suitable, is that we really openly have those professional conversations around actually what is suitable and actually what is this person's suitability or capability to complete that. Because I think we have to be mindful as well in terms of lots of different factors, not to set people up to something that's unrealistic. You know, we have to mind the vulnerability aspect that we're dealing with, that we're working with, and we need to make sure that we can make this as achievable as possible. And that's why when we started the work within restorative justice, we started calling it risk assessments, and then really quickly we decided it isn't a risk assessment, it's suitability and capability. That was the assessment, was really around actually, is someone suitable, but more so are they capable? Is this something that's realistic? And that's the bit that I think is a huge gap, particularly in learning disability, that currently still in the justice system we don't see it enough. We don't have that joint up professional understanding of the impact of learning disability. So it's all these individualised factors to me that are critical in terms of decision making, I think is really important.
What do you think are the biggest maybe kind of challenges in terms of restorative justice, because that is kind of your expertise?
I think the biggest challenge that I think we faced with restorative justice was the lack of understanding of what restorative justice is and what it can do. I think everyone immediately, so when we had some of the backlash around using restorative justice in sexual cases was, you know, we're going to put people together in a room and that's it. And it isn't the case, you know. We have lots of different approaches. We have surrogacy models. We have indirect conferencing that we can communicate through letter writing. There's all these different systems that we can use. So it was really about, again, that limited understanding of what restorative justice actually can look like. So I think that's certainly been that theme. But we've always went off the basis of what are people telling us? You know, what do people want? People that are in these situations, and restorative justice, I've seen it in practice. You know, I've worked in restorative justice in terms of, I've had various cases where I've seen it work really, really well. I've seen families reunified. It's not always got to be about that forgiveness. It can simply be an agreement. It can be the place, because court doesn't give us that opportunity to agree, you go to Tesco and I'll go to Asda. And what I mean by that is, if you've got people that are in the community together in the same town, that restorative process might not be about getting an apology. It might be about reassuring that survivor that actually, I will never go into that shop. So you can go to that shop anytime and you will never see me in that store. That gives someone that relief almost of, I'm not going to bump into them. Or they can make an agreement of, when you're walking and you see me walking towards you, can we please cross the road? We have an agreement. So it can allow lots of different dynamics to be established and different processes. So I think that's really important as well. Just have that wider kind of understanding, again, of raising awareness of what we're all trying to do, really.
So what do you do? Well, how involved are you particularly in like community sentencing?
So we have kind of, I don't have a great deal of operational role within CPO, or community payback. However, what we do, I suppose, is kind of advocate, I suppose, for that desistance approach and also that kind of reduction of short-term custodial sentencing. So certainly that's kind of underpinned within community justice values. And we actively kind of promote that within our action planning around that subject as well. But in terms of Midlothian, it's been really a really interesting approach to kind of, particularly in community payback orders. We made a really decision quite a few years ago that actually, before I was in post actually, that in Midlothian we don't believe in this high vis litter picking approach in terms of people out on the streets with community payback on the back. We really much believe in actually making CPOs meaningful. So what can be meaningful? And recently there's been a project where and the unpaid work team, they've been making hats for infants and for babies, so little wool hats, and it's something that's been really interesting. I think it's broken down so many barriers as well, in terms of what our expectations are and how we break stigmatization of people. So we do things like that. We have a lot of involvement kind of community gardens, for examples, as well, and really trying to do that. We also do a great deal of kind of qualifications, so first aid at work, for example, is one of them that we try and put people through, so that people are walking away with something, they've achieved something, and it's not just a case of turning up, it's actually making the time meaningful and making that kind of outcome focused, really. And I think there's a lot of, again, stigma that goes with these things, and I think that's really the role that comes back to us in terms of community justice, about how do we start to get public awareness better in terms of what a CPO actually means. And actually by seeing people going into short-term custodial sentencing, how the damage that potentially can have on their community. And I do see that for our next five-year plan is to help raise the awareness of public protection matters, to help get people to understand what CPOs really actually entail, but also what the damage short-term custodial sentencing can have in terms of people, you know, socialisation within custody, the impact on mental health, removal of employment, all these factors actually for a really short term is really detrimental to the community. So I think it's that whole debate of, you know, punishment aspect that we need to kind of work with a bit more in terms of getting people to really understand what these things mean. And I think the media certainly has a detrimental impact sometimes on how these things are reported.
Do you have any particular plans maybe that you can tell us about, that what has been planned in a round of kind of letting the community members and just other people know what it actually entails?
Yeah. So within our five-year plan, we're currently writing up at the moment, one of a couple of big actions that we're looking at is around working really closely with the Public Protection Office to kind of work with them to raise kind of awareness briefing sessions for communities. Previously, we've consulted a lot with communities, so asking them how they feel, we're asking them what they want to see different. But what I'm conscious of is actually I don't think we go back enough. So we ask a lot of questions, but we don't tend to go back and inform and help people understand. So our kind of plan is really to look at how we can do that. There's some work kind of we're developing even within local communities, kind of different environments that we can try to access, leisure centres, for example, to give people the chance really to do that. We also have a partnership with the Community Planning Partnership in Midlothian, so we sit there as a thematic lead where we have an annual conference that community members come to, and that's been a great opportunity for us to share kind of some of the findings and also share that information with. So it's certainly one that's really we're taking forward quite strongly in the next few years.
So if we go back a couple of years and bring up the topic of COVID or the pandemic, I wanted to know, how did the pandemic influence the work that you guys do overall? Because I'm assuming that things got turned upside down.
Yeah, I think it was I think we'll all agree it was incredibly difficult for everybody. I think also in terms of the increase of kind of social isolation and the impact that had in certain groups as well. I think we're still dealing with that a little bit. I think we're still going to have to explore that. We've certainly in our future action plan kind of considering areas such as growth of technology assisted kind of harmful behaviour, which I think's certainly been a theme that's been impacted quite significantly through that isolation, increase in mental health. I think these are themes that we have to start to think about. What has the pandemic actually done in terms of the longer lasting impact? But also the impact it had on teams in terms of staff teams. So when the pandemic started, I was still in my previous post, and then started this post in the middle of a pandemic, which was really quite strange, coming into a role like this and then actually having no peers because they were all on camera. And I think that was the bit. So it really impacted on staff morale as well. And I think in terms, we choose to work with people. We like people. So actually it was really difficult, I think, as a team in terms of all our teams here, not having that opportunity.
And how did you kind of, obviously it had an effect on the service that you guys provided, but how did you kind of counteract it? How did you make sure that the service was still of good quality or kind of wasn't maybe try to lessen the impact the pandemic had on it?
So as I said, I wasn't actually here at that time really as that
lead role.
But I think certainly for me as in my role in community justice, it was very much about looking at the actions we had on our current plan as a partnership and thinking about how we can support them, but ultimately prioritising what the really key areas were, I think, in terms of what we needed to do, what we had to think about. We published quite a lot of work at the time to support professionals in terms of that, you know, and looking at how we support different range groups within the community as well. So, yeah, I think it was very complex. I think certainly a lot of the practice teams, as far as I'm aware, were doing kind of home visits through windows, garden visits here. I think it was all these type of approaches, which I think we just had to really learn really quickly what to do and kind of do things differently. You know, and I think that's been the learning that's probably still to be fully evaluated and reviewed, really.
If I could just come in with a couple of follow-up questions here. You mentioned technology-assisted harmful behaviour there, David. What would you mean by that?
So I think, in particular, what we saw really was that kind of increase, I suppose, in terms of, particularly in children and young people, within the kind of technology-assisted harmful sexual behaviour. So when we were seeing the kind of responses to that, we've seen a bigger increase, and this is nationally, in terms of the increase of that population being a lot younger. So a lot of younger people kind of being charged with sexual offences due to online distribution, for example, of imagery. But one of the things I think that we had to, for me certainly, that we have to really focus and think about is the impact of the environment that had on children's learning as well, and also children's age and state of healthy sexual development. In terms of everyone was stopped, everyone was stunted, the socialisation was stunted. So all the healthy normative behaviours that we see within teenage groups were driven online, weren't they? And I think it's quite clear why we potentially saw some issues there, but also kind of the impact of that one isolation, mental health, we know that impacts on kind of decision making, we know that impacts on kind of risk-taking behaviours, for example. So it was certainly one of the themes that we've seen. So we've been doing kind of various different bits around that and scoping potentially how we respond to that, how we look at that. And I'm a real supporter of Stop It Now Scotland. I think the work they do is tremendous in terms of developing, you know, the some of the tools that they've came out with over the past year and during the pandemic were just phenomenal. So, yes, yeah, so we're hoping to kind of look at how we can respond locally to that and how we can potentially look at interventions that relate purely to technology.
Thank you. And you also mentioned social isolation there as something that obviously would be very familiar to many of us from the pandemic era. And I was wondering if you could comment at all on how that issue of social isolation has affected offending in Midlothian and affected your work more generally.
Yeah, I mean, I think potentially we're still quite early in terms of the data, you know, to really look at what the impact was. I mean, I think what we certainly have to acknowledge, I suppose, more kind of broadly is obviously that theme that, you know, particularly when we think of the referrals to mental health services, you know, the drastic waiting lists, the increase in demand, particularly on health professionals about responding to that. I think that's something that we've seen coming, but I think the impact of that isolation was really quite significant, and certainly within in relation to some of the themes around technology assisted behaviours, we can almost see that relationship there. We can see kind of why these relationships have taken place. Everything was kind of driven in that almost kind of underground world in terms of, you know, the response, the communications, and how some of that arguably, you know, became very, very complex. But I think the other bit is that we have to acknowledge is people coming out of it that actually liked the social isolation aspect. So the amount of people we speak to that really actually enjoyed COVID made them feel safe, they liked that isolation. I think that's potentially really problematic as well in terms of how do we encourage people back to this world that we used to live in almost, and what that looks like, because I think that's been a real challenge. Certainly my experience of working with people has been around actually the ones that were quite disappointed when lockdown stopped, because it gave them that opportunity to go there. And I think that's the bit that we have to acknowledge, that mental health has been a problem well before COVID. CAMHS waiting lists for children's services have been through the roof well before COVID. You know, and I think that's the bit as well, is that there's been factors there of COVID that have impacted on that, but also there's been factors that have been really difficult for people coming out of the other side of that too.
So one thing is that you'll be very much aware that there's quite a large backlog of unpaid work hours, I think currently standing at something like 700,000, although I know there was a decision to write off some of these hours. I was just wondering if you could comment a bit on how that's influenced your work, how that's influenced community payback in Midlothian.
So we've been in a really fortunate position. We don't really tend to have that issue. So our hours are actually reduced since pre-COVID, so we're in a different kind of position there. And I think that's been by showing a bit of initiative, really, in terms of how we've used the hours, how we've kind of accordingly, you know, used different things. So during the pandemic, it was about helping with food parcels, for example, in the local community, and trying to boost that. I think the one thing I would say in terms of the data is I think data sometimes requires that little bit of narrative. And I think sometimes, once again, data can and stats can be misinterpreted in so many different ways. So I think it's really important that we do have that understanding of what that looks like in each local area. But certainly in Mid, you know, the kind of response to that has been fairly positive. Yeah.
Great, thank you. It seems to come back to that point about meaningful activity, yeah, on community payback placements.
How would one get into this line of work if our listeners are interested in becoming part of this approach to justice work? Are there any alternative routes available?
I think one of my biggest, proudest achievements and my role in my career is actually coming from a place of a kind of unconventional approach to getting here. So I started off as a prison officer. went in to the prison service. I worked in the prison service at HMP Edinburgh for years, and I really owe a lot to that role in terms of understanding people, understanding how to manage conflict, but also managing how to talk with people and have those conversations, which I do think is something that we really have to have that understanding of. There's only so much we can get from academia in terms of what we read about and what we hear about, but actually being faced in those environments, and particularly when dealing with violence, understand how to manage violence and help people kind of desist from that behaviour is really, really critical. So I think that role for me was really positive in terms of that. I then progressed to that and went into Barnardo's and supported, went into children and young people, particularly around kind of child sexual abuse services and harmful sexual behaviour intervention and assessment services. And I was really fortunate at that stage that I got to go on and do a postgraduate certificate in child protection through the University of Stirling. So a really backward route in terms of how I got here, but I think that the experience and the practice I got was really, you know, I just really rate having that background in terms of working with people and almost getting that experience alongside the learning. And I do think there's some merit in that approach in terms of really coming out of that and getting that almost lived experience of understanding people and having that exposure to people.
Do you think that kind of maybe working backwards to get to a similar position with you, is that something that should be more celebrated, or like kind of maybe try and get it more like part of the practice in a way? I feel like a lot of the times people finish school and then it's an assumption that you have to go like to university, get a job. Is there anything that maybe the council is doing to kind of get people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's a lot of pressure, especially in kind of statutory services, so kind of local authorities, to have a professional identity. And it's something I suppose I've kind of fought with for quite some time in my career in terms of what is my identity, what do I want that to be? And I think that's really important that we don't always necessarily hold that, you know, accountable in terms of someone's experience and some things that people can bring. So again, I'm really an advocate for bringing in people that come from different backgrounds and bringing people that come from different experiences of systems that we try to manage, that actually there's a real place for having that worthy and meaningful and input from lived experience, but also living experience. So people that are currently in the system, it doesn't need to be someone that's been in it previously, someone that's in it now. And I think that's really something we need to start thinking about and taking new routes to learning. When I was at school, I couldn't wait to get out of school. I hated school. And now I'm writing papers with the University of Birmingham, which I'm incredibly proud of. I'm writing research pieces. I'm currently co-authoring a book. In high school, you'd have been lucky if I'd passed higher English. So I think it's something about when someone's ready. It doesn't necessarily mean you're not academic when you're at school, but I think that experience made me want to learn more about why people react the way they react and how we can help people better. So I think that gives us that thirst for learning, opposed to being told we have to learn.
Well, I think we should finish by asking you, David, if you have anything else that you'd like to add or anything that you think our listeners should know.
No, I'd just say thank you for having us. And also just in terms of, you know, there's so many resources out there. So if there are people looking for more information, you know, the Community Justice Scotland website is great. It's got all the different mapping exercises and things and the timelines. So yeah, certainly do that and have a look at some of the resources available.
I think that's us. Thank you so much, David. It was really interesting.
Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced to accompany the textbook Criminal Justice in Scotland by Jamie Puckin, Sarah Anderson and Katrina Morrison, published by Routledge. Many thanks to David Russell for speaking to us, and to Edinburgh Napier University and the Scottish Centre for Crime and Justice Research for their support and advice. The interview was by Gerda Lise Nurmia, with help from Jamie Buchan. Jamie also produced the episode.